Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. Hear me at the back? Yeah? Crawford? Okay. Does anyone have any issues? Questions about burning or unburning? Problems? Suggestions? Curtis?
Maybe you could talk. Somehow anger seems particularly difficult and complex emotional state. Because, and maybe part of it is that it's so interpersonal that, well, I'll give you, you know, maybe here's an example. So I'm, you know, I'm teaching more now, right? And I actually had a kind of a mentor come into one of my courses, and she said it went great. And one piece of feedback she said was, you know, when they were chatting in the back, sit quiet like you mean it. You know, basically, it seems like sometimes you say, kind of, do what you need to at the conventional level, something like that. Well, sometimes you need to express, emotionally express anger towards people in for the convention stuff to work. And I find that I can only express anger when I'm really irritated. Right? And so, yeah, anger, I find I need more than just kind of being aware of the anger. Maybe that's what I'm saying. Or maybe I'm missing something.
So there's two questions, is there? Three? All right.
Sorry.
Good. No. Thank you for giving me something to talk about. Okay, I go back to Ajahn Chah. And I always reflect, how did he operate? Okay? And no one messed with him. Just no one messed with him. He was a very powerful man, very confident, very compassionate, but very strong. No one played games with him. Right? And if I rarely saw anyone get angry at him, because I think they knew they couldn't get away with it. And he could be very strong, but I never sensed there was any anger, but there was tremendous authority, both, culturally, because culturally he understood his place in society and his own, authority in that culture, which is very important, I think. And, so he understood his people, the way they related to a leader and what his responsibilities were as a leader. And use that to the fullest in a wise way. And then emotionally, I really never saw him, get upset. Okay. So in terms of telling someone to be quiet, he could give a very strong desana to the monastery and everyone would be quiet. Right. Or he could be very forthright with someone and tell them they're just being nonsensical. No problem. So the need to actually get angry to assert authority, I don't believe in that myself. Because I've certainly tried it that way. And, it has worked sometimes in that way where I've had to just be in a kind of fighting energy because someone else is so blind. That it was almost kind of like an animal instinct to kind of defend myself. And it has been effective in that way, right? But I still have to carry the reverberations, either socially or in my own mind and body. So I can see in those situations, had I been more, had I been different, if If there was more equanimity and strength in the heart, there could have still been just as strong an answer. Okay? So there is a expressing for me, I can only tell you about me, right? Expressing myself in a forceful way, which where the anger comes through, if I'm sure that I'm not just coming from a blind defilement, I just know this is a kind of animal reaction to sort of survive in a situation, I don't get much residue from that. I don't get much residue. But if I've been carrying around annoyance at someone, and then I'm not mindful of that annoyance, and then one day I just bark at them, or I come from a wrong assumption, the repercussions are, you know, echoing me, you know, for many days. So, socially, we have to know what our responsibility is, and we have to know how to address those kinds of problems strongly, compassion, whatever way fits the situation. So to have any, there isn't kind of one size fits all, that doesn't work. And I think for me, when I contemplate, like in a monastery, I have a larger responsibility than just my own emotions. I have a responsibility to everyone here. And if something is going awry and no one is addressing it, then it's certainly my responsibility to address it because I have the authority. And if I have to address it strongly, I need to do that. So my feeling in the past has tended to be to back off, hope it'll change, hope it'll go away, back off, maybe someone else will say it, back off, and then scream, right? Which is an absolute disaster because it's kind of a build-up of energy. Whereas when I've been more skillful, I keep in touch with the stirring because something is maybe going wrong and there is someone in the community that really needs to know that they just can't do this anymore, that that's just not tolerable anymore. And if I stay in touch with my own defilement around that and I keep abandoning that, then there's a strength to face it, not move away from it, but also do it in a way where I'm quite clear this is appropriate. And when it comes from that, it might seem like it's, for me, it might seem like it's anger coming out, but it's not like just this defilement coming out. There is a strength, there is an appropriateness. This is wrong, you can't do that anymore. So I think there is a place for that. And I don't think that's anger. I think it's just the strength of what's morally appropriate. And if someone is so thick that they need a large stick to hear that, then so be it. Because sometimes people are just so thick. I remember once Ajahn Sumedho gave a really strong talk at Chithurst, early days. And everyone knew who he was talking about. Absolutely everyone. And this person was just so heedless and so insensitive. So Ajahn Sumedho kind of gave a really strong talk to everyone. And we all knew who he was talking about. And right after this talk, this person came up to Ajahn Sumedho and said, "Yeah, you really told him, didn't you?" Didn't have a clue. Didn't have a clue, right? Just thick as two planks. So, you know, that happens in any family or any situation. And then you have to somehow, you know, reflect to people, you can't do that. That's not wrong, you know. And if you as a teacher, then you have both the authority and the responsibility to do that because you're trying to educate the whole class. It's not just about you and this person. You have, so part of your learning as a teacher is to be able to do that. You know, you first of all, you shy off, then you say it too strongly. But somehow, if you make your own responsibility, you take on board, okay, what's my responsibility here? What is it that I'm doing? I'm not just teaching. I'm channeling this group of people to sort of some form of education or whatever. I think that's a good consideration. And then, like, if you're not used to being a teacher, you just learn. You just get better and better at it, better and better. So then you have to look at, like, the shyness to, like, wanting to be liked, wanting your students to like you, or not wanting to seem authoritarian. wanting to be kind of very liberal and hip and, you know, like... whatever, right? And you see, well, that doesn't fit here. You know, it might fit somewhere else, but it doesn't fit here. And so sometimes, oftentimes, you have to rise above your own limits of personality to some place of which is very unpleasant. You don't want to be there. You don't want to be an authority. You know, like the very word authoritarian already is pejorative, and yet, you know, we do have authority. And sometimes we need to call things. And if we don't, then we're not being responsible to that. And only, you know, in some places, not everyone has the authority to do these things. Only one person might be given that authority. So if another student tells them to be quiet, you know, the other student doesn't have the authority to say that. So you have to, I think you need to take that on board. But the more you take that role of teacher to look at how self-view comes up, especially the desire to be liked or the desire for your students to understand what you're saying, which is a wholesome desire, but any sense of self that arises with that, if you keep letting go or knowing that, that you keep letting go of the fear, and then you have more strength to lead with authority where it's appropriate, and to lead with democracy where it's appropriate, or, you know, whatever the social form calls for. So I think it's a big learning curve. I'm still learning, you know, being a teacher. It's like just part of me understanding my own, learning to be a kind of responsible individual in society through this particular form that happens to have come to me. Right? And, but anger itself, and annoyance, and, you know, there's a whole range there that are, it's kind of one third of the package of delusion, right? Greed, hatred, delusion. And first of all, there's a difference between hatred and a flare up of anger. Hatred is the persistent, following of a train of thought which wishes the downfall of someone else. It's a continued attachment to ill will. I think that's, for me, hatred. And that's a lot different than if I just get ticked off at someone. You know, that's a lot different. So that I think most of us understand. So if I'm sustaining ill will towards someone in a long-term fashion, you know, then that's really dangerous, because that creates a strong sense of self and other, and really embeds this energy in the mind, which really blocks any sense of opening to the spiritual qualities. It kind of preoccupies. So mind's a mind which is very unforgiving. Say, I'm not saying that's you know, but say if we just as an example, a mind which is very unforgiving. So hangs out in that lack of forgiveness that their mind is never available for peace. They're never available for peace. And the vice versa, being unforgiving to myself constantly, that preoccupation, I'm never available for peace because I have no mental space. My mind is just totally preoccupied with some form of aversion. So then in terms of working with anger, I think to awaken to the way the mind preoccupies with all sense of criticism, judgment, all the way to anger and rage is an important part of freeing your mind. And a lot of it is very, very subtle. You know, like you can be meditating and the mind can be just constantly criticizing what's going on and you're not even aware of it. Or constantly making comments about something or evaluating all the time. You know, that kind of critical faculty going all the time. So somehow I think it's important to learn how to come to no thought. To come to the capacity just to face life as a fact. And I usually say to people, you know, use sound, say, listen to sound and just face sound as a fact, not as a concept or an idea but just as a fact. So then you have to listen. And to listen, you have to stop. And when you stop, you're facing life as a fact. It's just this way now. And what I try to suggest to people, train in that, in the simplicity of that first. So maybe just the, like if I turned off the fan now, and it would get, you know, we'd feel the heat much more. Just take heat as a fact. To take it as a fact or to know it as a bodily feeling, I would have to stop thinking. If I started to think, why doesn't he turn the fan on? It's too hot. Maybe I'll go outside. Then I'm not facing it as a fact. But just as a fact, I have to stop thinking. It's just that way. It's a sound, bodily feeling. So if you understand what that is, if you understand what that is, then you can start to face the emotional world as a fact. So to actually face anger, irritation, annoyance as a fact. And this is not in the classroom. In the classroom, you've just got to get on with, well, yes, it is and it isn't in the classroom, but where you really learn about it is where life isn't so complex. So maybe you're on a retreat and, usually the complaints I get, people are talking too much. Okay, they're talking too much. Heard it for 40 years. Someone is talking too much by your, standard or my standard, and there's irritation there. So to collect, face irritation as a fact, this is irritation, means you have to stop thinking. But that's very hard to do, because what we tend to do is then think, I'm going to tell Veerdhamma, I'm going to tell the manager, I mean, or then we think, oh, it's okay, I mean, it's, you know, just let go. But we never face it as a fact. We either judge ourselves not to have that, or we evaluate it, or we want to go to the teacher or someone else, so the mind is always thinking. It never really faces it. This is the fact of irritation. And as soon as we do that, the fact this is irritation, it no longer has the same diluted power anymore. It's still there as a bodily feeling. It's still stimulated by people talking. But now because it's being observed as a fact, it's beginning to emphasize awareness. Anytime you face anything as a fact, what you're emphasizing is actually awareness rather than the object. If I say to you, listen, and you take the time to be conscious of sound, that's different than trying to listen to a sound. You take the time, and the wording is important. You take the time to become conscious of sound. What does that mean? That means that you're available. You have to stop thinking. Sound is there, but what it tends to do, it tends to emphasize awareness. It points to awareness. And then you're home again. You don't have to go anywhere. You're home again. And you do that with the body, do that with sound, do it with sight, so you can look at the shrine, and let the shrine become conscious as a visual object. So if I'm looking at the window, for it to become conscious, I have to stop thinking, that's a window, you know, we need to clean it, we don't need to clean it, it's open, it's closed, it's so on, you know, I have to stop thinking, and then it becomes conscious as a visual experience. But then because I'm not wrapped up in my concerns about the window, or definition of the window, whatever, it emphasizes awareness. So if you get that step right, in the ordinary, then you start to apply it to that complicated part of our consciousness, like emotions and self-doubt and self-disparagement, you know, the different kinds of things. And so then those habits of mind create a strong sense of self. And then to just say to yourself, well, what is it? What is this? Just what is the fact of feeling irritated? What is it really like? And it's funny how we can struggle with it. And in one moment you say, well, what's going on? You know, what's happening? And then all of a sudden, you notice the way things are. You're actually aware. So although we know what's going on, we're also not aware. Not really aware. We kind of know there's something happening, like irritation. But to face it like a really just a fact, just that way, means you have to stop. You have to stop the mind. And in the stopping of the mind, you're always emphasizing awareness. And that's your real home. And when you do that, the more there is, first of all, there's more body awareness. So with anger or greed or any of these things, again, use that language. Make conscious your body. let your body become feeling. Let your body become conscious of your body as feeling. Put it that way. Become conscious of your body as feeling. Now to do that is different than me trying to find the place of tension. Where am I tense? Which is a strong sense of self looking at the object called body. But if you just let the body become conscious as feeling, you have to be patient. It's different. It's a kind of, like, truth is very shy. Right? Truth is very subtle. Truth isn't gross. Self-disparagement is gross. But truth is actually, it's kind of like, yeah, it's like shy. It doesn't want to really appear. So you have to have a lot of patience with anger to let it become fully conscious, which isn't trying to get in there and analyze it and figure out where is it and what do I have to do it. That's still thought. That's still me having a problem called anger, and I want to get into it and I have to sort it out. And so there's analysis, there's evaluation, but it's never anger. It's always removed from anger, 1 or 2 degrees. So then to actually just to come to that, just to say there is anger is a big step in human development. There is anger. And to face it as a fact, not as a whole train of psychological techniques or Buddhist techniques or analysis, just as it is. Suchness. Just as it is. So then you have to wait. You have to be very patient. Just let it become conscious. And as you do that with the body, with body work like that, it becomes conscious. Then you begin to, it points to awareness again, and you begin to allow this kind of compressed energy called anger. It begins to open up the body in all kinds of tension ways, and it begins to be released. But that's not through thought. That's not me trying to release my anger because I've got an anger problem. That's by letting it become fully conscious. So we go back to Ajahn Sumedho's great phrase, consciousness is the escape hatch. And again, there's a difference between kind of knowing I feel angry and in being fully conscious of anger. So then, but that's the kind of work you often do initially in situations which aren't that great, you know, like irritation in a retreat or annoyance at the neighbor because they're too noisy or annoyance at the cat because it's done it all over the floor again or something. Something like that. And then you use the kind of simplicity of that, but it's still irritation, to understand the whole principle of being fully conscious. And as you become fully conscious, you begin to find a smile in your heart. I know it sounds smarmy, a smile in your heart, not because things are unpleasant or pleasant, but because you've come home. You realize, yeah, I'm here again, I'm back. Usually the smile of the heart comes when things are pleasant. Everything's going well and people are cooperative and you're healthy and you just got an increase in your wage packet or something like that. So then, oh, right. But actually you begin to see that when you awaken in full consciousness, that's home and you've got nothing, nowhere to go. Just stay there. And if you trust in that, you have to trust in that. Then these negative things are very threatening. And it's just kind of feeling I should be doing something about this. But that's not what you want to do because there's nothing to do really in that sense. It's to be fully conscious. To let it go through you. To let it cease. And if I have a lot of training in techniques and analysis and going into my own history, da 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 da, it's very hard just to face it as a fact. Not only is there the anger, there's all that other baggage around it. Whereas something like sound, it's much easier. It's much easier. Or just heat. It's much easier. But it's the same principle. It's pointing back to anger. And then as we work that way, then like subtle things, like the endless anticipation in the mind. Or the endless evaluation. You know, the mind's always kind of making some kind of evaluation, taking us away from the deep silence and peace of the mind. Even that, you begin to know that. And just come back to this pure consciousness. So in theory, every experience takes you deeper into awareness. That would be right practice. So every experience indicates what? That this is the way it is now. And to actually take a negative experience, like, say, self-disparagement, maybe, and to know, oh, just face it, this is self-disparagement, and not have to do anything about it, analyze it, figure it out, where is it from, do no evaluation, just the way it is, let it become conscious, makes you more mindful. So every situation points to awareness. All situations, if you take like a sitting, just a half hour sitting or 45 minute sitting, you feel maybe a little bit discomfort. You're not used to sitting, but you stay with it, don't you? Discomfort feels this way. And that takes you deeper into awareness, the very discomfort. Whereas the reactive mind just wants to get out of the discomfort. So you use, and maybe some mood comes up that you feel the wind, you know, the fan is too cold. You feel a bit annoyed, oh, it's too cold. And you just go with that. This is what it feels like to be too cold. Not to hurt yourself, obviously, but, and then that takes you deeper into awareness. So each situation, if you're practicing mindfulness, takes you deeper into awareness. Whereas the mind, which is always thinking that like, one state is better than the other, then it doesn't. So how can anger take you more deeply into awareness rather than anger being a problem which you have to sort out? That would be my suggestion. Because when you have a powerful emotion, then it's really hard to be mindful of it. It's really hard just to be fully conscious of the unpleasantness of it. Because we're used to blaming, running away, distracting, going to the pleasant, blaming ourselves. We're not used to being with that kind of unpleasant structure. So then it's a kind of challenge. Okay, just the way it is. Don't touch it. Yeah, but what if I... And the mind just starts thinking very quickly. So I think there's two. There's the social component, going back to your question, which I think has to do with authority and responsibility and the capacity to oftentimes rise above your personality characteristics that would normally function in a different situation and learn how to act through that. And sometimes it might take a bit of jumping up and down, which you're not used to. I don't know, but sometimes there's a shyness and then you have to go beyond it by being maybe stronger than you're used to. And then you get used to doing it or whatever. But that's a good reflection as a kind of mature human being in culture. You know, I do have responsibility. This is my job. You know, so I have to do that. So there's that. And then there's that kind of internal work. So actually just watching anger is not that simple. It's because usually we're not watching anger. We're just thinking something. We're not, really to be fully conscious of it. Quite often we're not doing that. And then it kind of dissipates on its own and then we get distracted by something else. But to make it fully conscious in the body is quite a challenge. Yeah? It's 3.5. Anyone else for anything? I mean, I just suggest make some suggestions on lying meditation. Those of us who are getting older, lying meditation is quite difficult because we fall asleep. Right? And yet, as our bodies get older and the knees are less and less able to sit and so on and so forth, and any time really, I think it's an important posture to try to develop meditation in. And obviously, when you're very tired, then you lay down to fall asleep. But more and more I meet people who wake up in the middle of the night, they can't sleep, they don't want to get up and meditate, do walking meditation, sit cross-legged and so on, they don't want to do that. So they kind of toss about. So for myself, in developing lying meditation, I think my most important insight was that, first of all, to make the intention to meditate, right? So that I would actually say, if I woke up in the middle of the night and I'm not really that sleepy anymore, but my body doesn't really want to get up at two or three in the morning to meditate because I've been busy all day. Well, then I'll take a posture in bed, but I'll do it quite deliberately by saying to myself, no, this is a meditation posture. And that's important because intention is very important when you're going to meditate, right? So if you think about the sitting posture, we've all developed a posture that is associated with meditation. You know, when I sit this particular, this cushion, all the associations are about meditation and stillness and so on. But when we lay down, all the associations are for sleep, for annihilating consciousness, for falling asleep. So you have to change the intention. The intention now is to meditate. So you make that statement to yourself. And then lying down, in the text they say you should lie on your right side. I've never found that helpful because my arm falls asleep. So I lie on my back and I tend to put my hands on my thighs. So I'm just kind of like corpse posture in yoga. But then most important thing is that I do make the intention, okay, this is meditation now. And then I found that the next thing is to take the first sensation of discomfort and not move and use that first sensation of discomfort to deepen my awareness, just as I was saying about any state of mind. So as you're lying there, as I'm lying there, then some discomfort comes up. Now the associations with sleep are to shift around into a posture which is more comfortable so that I can fall asleep, right? I mean, that's the way we associate lying down. But now, because I've made a determination to meditate, because there's lots of energy there, now I actually make that intention. When you want to move, don't move, but observe the feeling of discomfort. And that's not a rigid kind of demand. Don't move, because that's just willfully coercive set. This isn't like that. It's saying, keep still, but notice the feeling of wanting to move. Notice the discomfort. And if I do that, when the discomfort comes, and it's, again, it's not much, it's just normal, isn't it? So it doesn't hurt. It's quite comfortable, actually. It's just something, some tension or whatever. And I just notice that. And that deepens the awareness and takes you into the body, takes you away from thought. The difficulty with lying meditation, one of them is the attention usually goes into thinking and the mind just goes into that kind of porridge state, blah, blah, blah. And the energy for like sitting meditation quite often comes that you have to hold your back up. You have to open your chest. You have to raise the energy up your spine, right? In sitting posture. So then the lying posture, the intention, then it can take a while to get used to this because there's usually less vitality in the posture than like some kind of stretching or something like that to get you more into the body. But I found if I just notice each desire to move, I use that, and the body awareness of that, the discomfort, that takes me deeper into awareness. And then from that I found that if I could then begin to feel the body as like a large unit, rather than trying to focus on my breath or whatever, just feel the body as a kind of large unit of sensations, and that the body is lying in awareness. I'm not in my mind, in my head, looking at my body. The body is lying in awareness, or is sensate in awareness, or it is feeling in awareness. That kind of sense, a broader sense of spacious awareness, and then the body energies begin to be known as different kinds of vitality, rather than kind of going off into thought. Those aren't many suggestions, but it is worthwhile, especially if you have, you know, various kinds of pains in sitting practice. I think it's worthwhile to develop a lying posture. Like if you're doing a longish retreat, or you want to extend like an afternoon of meditation, to actually see if you can, you know, if you have a lot of vitality, see if you can alternate sitting, lying, sitting, usually sitting, walking, sitting, and to get used to, or all four, sitting, walking, standing. Standing I've not developed much. I've only seen one monk who actually does that. He's a monk I met in Wellington. He would stand for 2 or 3 hours. I've never seen that. He said he really liked it. But anyway, somehow to develop a kind of body awareness, both in sitting and lying, where you feel the whole body, where you're not just kind of locked into one part of the body and reacting to it. So one of the teachers I like, he calls it a global awareness. Kind of a global, like the whole body being in consciousness. Because a lot of our kind of evaluation, anticipation, the things which block the deep peace of the mind are very much locked in the body. You know, it's very much conjoined. And as you get a sense of the kind of wholeness of the body as an energy system, you tend to be less locked into the thoughts too. There's a kind of spaciousness there. So the meditations in space, and space around the body, awareness of space, those are interesting things to just try to not conceptualize. Can you imagine awareness of space and that the body is in space? That, those kinds of imaginings help with that kind of contraction. But as I was saying earlier, in meditation, one of the things you're trying to notice as your meditation becomes more subtle is this tendency always to anticipate and evaluate. The mind's always like, that was good. Am I getting there? Or that's not, you know, this constant little nittering, nattering of thought. Not very loud. Just loud enough to prevent you from being peaceful. But to then recognize that, this is evaluation. Or this is anticipation. And to take the mind to that sense of stillness and listening. Takes you deeper into the silence of the mind. Otherwise, the mind's always in a kind of superficial judging and evaluation. Anne?
In my practice, I've been noticing that I have delusions arising, colors, and weightlessness, and I'm wondering whether those are healthy and skillful things or unskillful.
Well, if it makes you feel more and more relaxed and peaceful, that's a good sign. So take that. As we meditate, we can get very strange body perceptions, like weightlessness. Sometimes we'll feel like 10 foot tall. That's a kind of common one too. Yeah. And what you want to do is that's just a perception. And rather than get fascinated by it, you take that perception, this is what it feels like to be weightless. Rather than looking around and see if you're floating. That's it, yeah, it's just a change in perception. But when that first happens, you go, oh, what was that? And then we're thinking again, and then looking forward or whatever. So if you remember, the principle is that awareness is the gateway to the deathless, and everything else which changes, like perception of bodilessness or weightlessness or largeness, is simply a perception. So your mind probably relaxed, and that was felt. So if you keep that as your main principle, then anything else is a red herring. You know, devas coming and whispering in your ears, angelic trumpets blowing their horns, Mara coming and saying, you're no good, you're hopeless. It's all red herrings. None of it. It's just awareness. And each time you remember awareness, say, great. Make it a really positive affirmation rather than, oh gosh, you know, my meditation isn't going good and I need to try harder now and that kind of stuff. That's still me in time. That's not deathless. It's still time bound me. You'd be amazed that your mind just seems like a total wipeout, basket case washout, and you awaken and you just stay, I'm good. I'm home again. And the mind's silent suddenly. Amazing sometimes. Rather than it being a kind of progressive hammering away, bashing the thoughts down, climbing the peak to get there, that kind of it's different than that. Yeah, and letting it happen is actually very profound. Being awake enough to allow things to happen, to be fully conscious, is actually very profound. Because usually we're trying to make them happen. And there's a difference. You know, me trying to accomplish what I had in last meditation or what I've read in the book or all the rest of it. To actually keep the mind very open to the the reality of this moment as it is. It's actually very hard because desire comes in, or we have desire from all kinds of other ideas, or we have a lot of judgmental habits, and that kind of purity of awakeness is covered over by these things. But any time, just keep affirming things that work, things that make your inner, like deeply relaxing in the core of your being. That's important. That open your heart to other beings, you know, where you're less alienated, less separated. That you feel, you know, confident and positive. Those are very, very important things to affirm, but not to manufacture. It's a different, you know, affirming that this works is different than trying to manufacture it from desire. Doesn't work. Yeah. That's all from memory. Memory doesn't work that way. You're trying to manufacture something I had yesterday. I can understand the process, but I'm not trying to manufacture, because the process is of letting go into the present moment rather than becoming someone in the future. That's why it's unconditioned, deathless. You know, that's the language we use. Coming back into the moment. It's very counterintuitive in many ways. And it's against the flow of craving. It's against the flow of the world. That's why the Buddha, I think, one of the reasons why the Buddha thought, this is too difficult. You know, this is too, because the world is so taken by craving, by becoming, by getting, by accumulating, and all the rest of it. And so you kind of see the profundity of the words like letting go. Very profound, that. It's not so easy. Not so easy. Okay. So we cash in our chips. We'll finish there. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.